Good afternoon and welcome to the meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. And a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we're well into our 31st year. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen or journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today we are delighted, and I would add lucky, to have as our speaker Ambassador Jack Matlock, a career diplomat, a Russian expert who capped his career as ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1987 to 1991, at the time the Cold War was ending and then the Soviet Union collapsed. Since retiring from the Foreign Service, he's focused on understanding how and why the Cold War ended and what lessons from that experience are relevant to foreign policy today. He's written several books about the period, Autopsy on an Empire, and Reagan and Gorbachev, How the Cold War Ended. He lives in Princeton and visits Moscow several times a year, and in fact just returned from his most recent visit there this past Friday, which gave him time to unpack, repack, and drive up here on Saturday. So a really warm welcome to Ambassador Jack Matlock.
Thank you very much, and for those kind words, and particularly for the invitation. Rebecca and I really enjoy a chance to come back to Maine. We don't get here all that often. We have a few times, and it's always a very pleasant experience. And it's also wonderful to be able to meet several, re-meet several of our colleagues in the Foreign Service and in government service in Washington. So thank you for bringing us here. I think we're going through a time where many people are misinterpreting in important ways some of the foreign policy issues that come before us. We hear more and more that the rhetoric of the Cold War, and even speculation that we may be entering a new Cold War, particularly with the events in Ukraine, I might say in and around Ukraine, over the past few months, and the increasing, I would say, bitter rhetoric being exchanged between the Russian president and our president and the leaders of many of our European allies. And you would think from the talk that maybe this is a replay of the Cold War. Let me say right up front, I don't think so. And as a matter of fact, to compare what is going on today with the sort of problem we had in the Cold War is a bit of a travesty, in my opinion. Let's not forget that the Cold War was about a worldwide confrontation of two ideologies that were fueled by one of the most incredible arms race in the history of mankind. At the height of our confrontations during the Cold War, the two of us probably had something like 80, 90,000 nuclear weapons. I remember at the time that some calculated that if they were all used, they would destroy civilization maybe seven times over. And you were asking, well, once you've done it once, why do you need to do it again? Obviously, the point, though, was not that they were to be used. It was to keep them to be used against you. We had wars and proxy wars and the Far East, Vietnam, Korea, you could go all around, and then other wars like in Cambodia, a tremendous amount of things. This, what is going on today, is in no way comparable to what was going on in the Cold War, and the comparison of the rhetoric over what is a rather limited issue, and one which has much more characteristics of a family dispute, and I'll get into that later, a local family dispute, than it does the sort of confrontation we had during the Cold War. So, but in order to understand that, let me spend just a few minutes talking about Ukraine and why this is a problem and to try to put it in a context, because what we are seeing is a real crisis, a real revolution, and a potential war, civil war, in Ukraine. And to understand some of the features there, I think we need to look at some basics. First of all, we need to make sure we know where Ukraine is. The Washington Post did a survey, a poll, a couple of weeks ago, and they found out that only 1 in 6 Americans could place Ukraine on the map. So there it is, and you can see a long border. This is when Crimea was still part of it. But the position is important. Even more important, though, is something of the history. Now, Ukraine is not a country which has existed for centuries or even very many decades. It is made up of territory that was put together, some of it, from the end of World War II, put together, never consulting the people involved. So this is a country which you might say was artificially assembled by outsiders for various reasons. You can see there where various parts came in and the dates. But this is not just a matter of history. When we look at what was happening in the elections since Ukraine became independent at the end of 1991, we will find that there's one group of parties that win in the West by huge majorities, another group that tends, or parties that win in the East by huge majorities, and the country is very much divided along lines that coincide with the lines of their putting together in history. Now, here's another one after the so-called Orange Revolution in 2004. Here again, you see that Yanukovych got over 90% in some of the provinces where, Yushchenko, I'm sorry, got it backwards. Yushchenko got over 90% over in Lviv and some of the western provinces, whereas Yushchenko, he's the president that was just in February ousted by the revolution, got well over 90% over in the east. As a matter of fact, you can see here that these divisions continued. Now, in 2010, same pattern. Yanukovych is the red, Tymoshenko, the dark and the blue, and this division is there. In the mid-90s, I went to Kiev with a group of former employees of our National Security Council. And there was a project of the Atlantic Council to discuss with them how we handle national security. And we made a presentation of how our NSC operates and with the various departments. And then the Ukrainian officials that we were dealing with got up and put a map similar to this on that and said, when you're talking about national security, you're talking about foreign affairs. Our problem is not foreign. Our problem is internal. And they showed us one of these maps. And this is something we need to bear in mind. Now, another correlation though it's a complex one, is what language do people speak? Often people say, well, you know, Ukraine is only 20% or so Russian. Well, that doesn't mean it's necessarily 80% Ukrainian. There are other nationalities there, but a more relevant political question for Ukraine has been, what language do people prefer to speak? And over 40% prefer to speak Ukrainian. Over 40% prefer to speak Russian, whether they are ethnic Ukrainian or ethnic Russian. There are some who don't matter, and a lot, if you'll see in this tan here, speak a mixture of the two languages. But the language issue has been an extremely important one, because the people from the West are champions of Ukrainian culture. They keep trying to not only give Ukrainian culture privileged position, but at times not to teach Russian at all. So you find many Russian speakers in the center of them who I'm told speak excellent Russian. It's their native language, but are never taught it at school. They're only taught Ukrainian, so they can't write it properly. When you go to economic activity, you'll find also very interesting things. Obviously, in terms of the greatest product, the capital, this is true many places, and the province around it is tops. But as you go east, you find most of the industry and so on. The West has been more agricultural. And you'll see that there is more GNP by province in the east than in the West. Salary differences. Here again, typical salaries are much higher in the East than they are in the West. So we get these really strange, really distinct differences. And when we look at the current problems there, starting in January, where did the mass protests start? Started in the West primarily. And then where did they start taking over government buildings? Started in the West. You know, the current issues are over the East, where they took over the buildings, and there have even been agreements. There was one between Secretary Kerry and Minister Lavrov that the unofficial, these gangs or local militias that took over government buildings should give up their arms and evacuate them. Well, nobody did. And we said, well, the Russians didn't make those in the East come out. And the Russians said, hey, you didn't make those in the West leave. So, you know, what are we talking about? You know, or are we simply talking about one side or the other side? Now, Crimea, briefly. Crimea's history has been entirely different from that of the rest of Ukraine. And it was included as part of Ukraine by simply, you might say, a bureaucratic act. When Nikita Khrushchev was General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, when they were celebrating the 300th anniversary of the Cossacks making an agreement with the Tsar to include what is now Eastern Ukraine in Russia, they decided that, well, we'll give you Crimea, that is, transfer Crimea from Russia to Ukraine as sort of a gift because of your loyalty to Moscow and to Russia. Nobody asked the residents then. In fact, it didn't make any difference because Ukraine was ruled out of Moscow by, you know, a centralized government. You know, I'm not even sure that our embassy would have even reported this in a cable. They might have sent an airgram for the record that, well, you know, the map will now show Crimea as part of the Ukraine SSR. But it's interesting, this is something a lot of people forget. Even then, they left Sevastopol, the naval base, where the naval base under the direct control of Moscow and not of Kiev, that is, of Ukraine. The population there is, the great majority are Russian, ethnic Russian, ethnic speaking. And let's say the Russians have said all along since their recent occupation of Ukraine, Crimea is a special case. It is a special case in terms of history, in terms of emotions. And that's one of the problems, is that when you don't recognize these, you might say, subtleties, very important subtleties, things are different. Now, the Russian mobilization that occurred was along the eastern border, and this occurred after the revolution in Kiev that ousted the previous government. You know, when the Cold War ended, many of us thought that we really had a possibility to bring about a new world order. This was one of the words that the first President Bush used. We, frankly, those of us who remembered World War II and so on, were worried a little bit about those words, because we knew that Hitler had called his Neue Ordnung, the New Order, and well, we didn't want it to be confused with that. But the idea was that countries would no longer invade other countries, would respect borders, and we had agreements at Helsinki and also the UN Charter, others that would seem to make that possible, and that was the whole rationale, of course, for the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, when Iraq had invaded Kuwait, occupied it, and we, with the support of UN resolutions, NATO, and most of the Arab countries, we, of course, led a coalition and reversed that. And second, we also began to use the phrase a Europe whole and free. However, many people, both here and elsewhere, began to look at the world as if the United States and secondarily its NATO allies had ended the Cold War by in effect conquering the Soviet Union. Now that was a complete misunderstanding. We negotiated an end of the Cold War to the benefit of both countries and everybody else. And we removed not only a great threat and the expense of this insane arms race, but we had established, in cooperation with Gorbachev and the senior people, a relationship of trust, so that we could discuss the most sensitive issues and settle them without a lot of of public debate, which would have made it difficult for both sides. When we found that the Soviets had a massive biological warfare program, which they were not closing down in 1980, instead of publicizing this, President Bush, the first President Bush, sent me and the British ambassador to Gorbachev's foreign policy assistant saying, we've got this evidence, you got to close it down. And do it before, you know, this all becomes public. And by cooperating with him in a few things over the next few months, we got it closed down. At least we got his decision to close it down in a way that was effective. And that was only one of many things I could note around 1980 and around 1990 and 91. And when it came to Eastern Europe, the Eastern Europe was freed as the Cold War ended, or maybe after it ended, when Gorbachev and Bush made an agreement, a general agreement, when they met in Malta, that the Soviets would not use force in Eastern Europe, But the United States would not take advantage of their withdrawal from control of Eastern Europe. And then when we were negotiating the unity of Germany, we made special conditions so that NATO jurisdiction would not fully extend into the territory of what had been East Germany. And at that time, many statements were made that there would be no expansion of NATO to the East. Now, these were not legally binding commitments, but they were a negotiating position which recognized that if we were going to free Eastern Europe, if we were going to have a Europe whole and free, you couldn't just keep moving the Western military alliances into the area that the Soviets were retreating from, that was simply not going to create a Europe whole and free. Now, this meant that later, under a different administration, when the issue came up in the mid and late 90s, many of us argued that we should not expand NATO as when it started in the Clinton administration, not simply because there had been a promise. One could question whether that was a promise regarding Eastern Europe, but because it was simply bad policy. If you start expanding this organization, at some point you either have to stop if you don't include Russia, or you're going to have major problems. Think of how the United States would react if some European or Asian power would try to change the government in Mexico to one that was anti-US. I mean, we know what happened when the Germans started negotiating in 1917 to try to get an alliance with Mexico. We went to war against Germany, and that was one of the reasons. Now, so it was clear even when we started that if you're going to start this, okay, they may accept Poland and Czechoslovakia and so on, but at some point you're going to have to stop where their historical borders are. No, we didn't. And in the 2000s, we began to talk. We not only brought the three Baltic countries into NATO, the Balkans, all of those that had once been in the Warsaw Pact, but we began to talk about preparing Ukraine and Georgia for NATO membership. You know, I just at the time, I wondered, you know, are people going mad? Well, one thing, two-thirds of the Ukrainians didn't want to be in NATO, and why we would want to take on the responsibility to use our blood and treasure to defend people who don't want to be defended, I don't know. I mean, what were people thinking? And, of course, we got militarily involved with Georgia, which was having problems with its some of its minorities. It was trying to put them down by military force, the way we didn't want the Russians to put others down. These things got very complicated, but when the war in Georgia broke out, which was a brutal one, the Russians attacking, they were responding with what had been an aggressive Georgian policy in these areas that they claimed, but actually many of the people didn't want to be in Georgia. And the Georgians were using massive military support from the United States. It was 1 year, the military support went up to nearly $1 billion. Now, if we had really wanted Georgia to recover those territories, we should have given them economic aid so that they were living better. But because they sent some of the troops to Iraq, we put massive things in, and the Russians looked at this as if you are trying to surround us with bases. And in this whole area, one of the most crucial ones for them was the Crimea, because it has the Black Sea Fleet, one of their principal naval fleets. And just about the only port they have that's completely ice-free year-round. They had divided the Black Sea Fleet with Ukraine when the Soviet Union broke up. But obviously, if Ukraine came into NATO, their vision was that that would soon be a U.S. naval base. And historically, this is something that, I mean, it would just send almost any Russian up the wall. Some of their most important battles have been fought there. I don't know how many of you remember Tennyson's poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade, which has the wonderful lines, "Ours not to reason why, ours but to do and die." And this was a British charge on up one of the hills protecting Sevastopol during the Crimean War of the 1850s. Who was on the other side of that? Leo Tolstoy, the author of War and Peace, was an officer in the artillery defending that. You know, these battles, I mean, Sevastopol is, I would say, the Alamo squared in terms of of Russian military history. To have this come into question by the possibility of NATO membership, again, is something that has motivated on their side. How about our own attitude toward these things? As the Soviet Union was threatening to break up and going more and more in that direction, our first President Bush went to Kiev after a visit to Moscow, August 1st, 1991, and made a very important speech because he recommended to the Ukrainians and to the other non-Russian republics that they adhere to Gorbachev's Union Treaty. This was an attempt to create a voluntary union. And he said there, "Don't confuse independence with freedom. Choose freedom." Because we knew that many of these local rulers were not pushing the reforms that Gorbachev was. And you suddenly go to independence then, you're going to end up with a worse situation in terms of democratic development than you would if they had stayed with Gorbachev. And he also warned against suicidal nationalism, because at that point, and that was directed at Georgia, at that point, the Georgians were already using military means against some of their minorities in South Ossetia. So, you know, at that point, we considered it, and I think quite rightly, that preservation of a democratizing voluntary Soviet Union, excluding the three Baltic countries, which we always wanted to regain their independence, was a better solution than sudden independence for everybody. Now, Bill Sapphire, the New York Times columnist, called it his chicken Kiev speech. The idea being that, you know, a breakup of the Soviet Union was very much in our interest. Well, many of us at the time questioned that. But the fact is that we see now, and this is something that I have trouble still understanding, that at the time we thought we were better off if Ukraine stayed in some sort of association with Russia, in some sort of union. And now it seems that the worst thing in the world that could happen to international law is for somehow Ukraine either to be broken up or for Russia to take land. Now, there is no question that in the invasion of Crimea, Russia violated international law and violated commitments that had been made by the Soviet Union in the Helsinki Final Act, which says that borders should not be changed except by the consent of both the parties. And of course, countries are you are not supposed to invade another country unless it has attacked you. This is also against international law, the exception being if it's a humanitarian issue or something, the UN Security Council has to authorize it. Well, it does seem to me that we, the United States, made some mistakes, which makes it not entirely convincing for us to use some of the arguments we've used. For example, in bombing Serbia over Kosovo, and there was a real humanitarian issues involved there, but we did not have UN authorization. And then in, I think, 2008, we recognized Kosovo as independent without the approval of Serbia. Now, that the first, you would say, was a violation of Serbian sovereignty, the second a violation of a commitment under the Helsinki Final Act, and then, of course, the invasion of Iraq without UN approval, and in fact, for reasons which turned out to be without a solid foundation. Again, these two things had begun to turn Russian opinion against the United States. But also, it means that when we say now, as Secretary Kerry did at some point, well, in the 21st century, nations shouldn't invade others. And the Russians would say, so, and 2003 is not in the 21st century? Didn't you invade Iraq when we told you no? And the French told you no, and the Germans told you no. And your president says you're an exceptional nation. That means you have rights nobody else does. Well, I don't want to go on and on except to say that the problem is Ukraine is a failed state. None of their leaders have been able to achieve a sense of unity. And it is in Russia's backyard. For over three centuries, much of it was an integral part of the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. There are all sorts of historical and cultural ties. And the fact is that our representatives were trying, in effect, to set up a government which the Russians would consider anti-Russian. And it looked, it seems to me, that all of the parties involved here bear at least some share of the responsibility. Now, I don't like what President Putin has been doing in Russia any more than many Russians do. But by handling this issue the way we have greatly strengthened him at home. And I don't think that was our objective. He was running probably somewhat less than 50% approval until the whole Crimea thing came out. And now he's running over 80% because Russians look at this as a restoration of territory that should have been theirs, that never should have been elsewhere. And one that the residents recognize. And when I was in Moscow last week talking to people, the question I would get most often is, do Americans really understand what's going on here and what they're doing and the effect here? And frankly, I would say the short answer is no. And I think I would tell them, you're also misinterpreting the American view, because we didn't really expand NATO in order to get at Russia. We didn't bomb Serbia to threaten Russia. There were reasons for this. The East Europeans needed protection. There was a problem in Kosovo, which Russia wasn't cooperating. You know, there are two sides to these things. And when I'm there, I try to explain that. But the thing is that when the Cold War ended, end of 91, early 92, over 80% of the Russians looked at the United States as a friendly country, indeed as an example to aspire to. And now somewhat nearly 80% feel that America is a threat. And of course, every time you have someone like a senator or Governor Romney speaking of them as an adversary or as an enemy, this is played in their press as if it represents the opinion of the whole country. And the, one of the questions, I'll just conclude with this, when I met with former President Gorbachev for about half an hour, we were both very disappointed that the sort of relationship that we had when he was president didn't exist now, where our presidents could work things out quietly. And his question was, who is pushing this in the United States? Is it your military-industrial complex? And it's a question I have to ask, too. I recall a call just before, in the spring of 91, Colin Powell, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs, came on a visit. He met with Gorbachev. Gorbachev opened the meeting by saying, "General, I feel sorry for you." And Powell said, "Well, Mr. President, what do you mean?" And he said, "I've taken away your enemy. You're going to have trouble getting your appropriations next year." Well, let me leave it at that. I know we'll leave time for questions.
If Russia does seize the East, Ukraine falls apart, and West Ukraine then joins NATO, how bad is that?
I'm not sure it would be all that bad. But frankly, I don't think Russia wants to seize the East. East Ukraine is a total basket case now. They've got the most enormous economic problems. And I know I was discussing this again last week with Alexander Besmertnik, who was sort of the last Soviet foreign minister. And he said the whole idea that we want East Ukraine, this is crazy, that nobody, now he said, you know, if they started civil war there, Putin may be forced to try to, you know, calm it and send in, but he said this is the last thing we want. They don't want that burden. Now, in fact, you know, I really think the big historic mistake was Stalin taking Lviv and these areas in the West. And let's not forget that was a deal between Hitler and Stalin. These people should have never been taken into the Soviet Union, nor the Baltic states, nor Moldova. And much of the breakup of the Soviet Union was generated from that area. So one could make a case that Ukraine is better off as two countries and without Crimea. You can make a case that if they're able to keep Ukraine together, Ukraine is really better off without Crimea. I know this can be an emotional issue, but the Crimeans were supporting the people from the East. There'll be less support there. It's going to be easier to unite the country, if it's ever possible, without it. So, you know, to think just at, you might say, the most superficial of legalities, and I don't mean they're not important, and say, well, that was a violation of international law because it's an invasion of another country. All right, another country, but was it really another country? And what is the history here? What are the emotions here? And when you just look at the legalistic aspect and not the other, you get, a distorted view.
We've got two questions that sort of relate directly to the future. If you were in Moldova right now, would you be concerned? And the second question, the related one, is to what extent is there valid concern of a domino effect with Belarus, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Moldova? Should they be concerned?
I don't think the Baltic states need to be concerned whatsoever. They're in NATO. They would get protection. There will not be any military movement against them. That would be insane. You know, I think George Soros wrote recently that Vladimir Putin is a judo specialist. He's not a sadist or necessarily so stupid he would want to reconstitute the Soviet Union. He is using this talk about a new Russia and the need to protect Russians abroad as an emotional issue to support what he took Ukraine, Crimea. And that, I think, doesn't mean he plans to go elsewhere. Now, I do think that the attempt by Russia to bring some of these republics in to an economic union was very misplaced. It's not going to be to their advantage, but it's also not going to succeed. But I think one thing we have to recognize is the sort of proposals that the EU was making are also not going to succeed in the country as it is now there. Whoever gets Ukraine or part of it is going to have a real burden. Now, that's the fact of the matter. So I think that to look at this as an East-West issue is simply putting it in the wrong perspective. The problem is in Ukraine, and so far, the influence of the outside, outsiders have exacerbated the problem, and that includes Russia and the West, rather than helping them solve it. Is there an example of how to solve this problem? Yes. I say, look at Finland's history. We used to talk about Finlandization. You know, the Finns were very careful not to poke the Soviets or the Russians in the eye. And yet they kept a very independent thing. They never got into NATO. They didn't need it. And in fact, trying to go to NATO would have created problems for them. When we got Austria free after the occupation, they pledged neutrality. Why can't Ukraine pledge neutrality and say, we're not applying for NATO membership? What the Russians are asking for is, in principle, not that bad. They have asked for a federal system so that it's not a winner-take-all. Before, you got 51% of the votes. You were president. You named all the governors. It was winner-take-all in a country which is as divided as we have seen. Second, they want the Russian language to have equal validity with Ukrainian, and that's a very emotional issue. I think they're absolutely right. You know, suppose the Irish had said, if you can't speak English or be a full-fledged Irishman. I mean, come on. If they want a sense of Ukrainian nationality and a sense of Ukrainian national unity, it's got to include both languages. I mean, and then the third is neutrality. Don't join NATO, in effect. It seems to me there's nothing unreasonable about it. All of those things would be, you might say, true in Finland, which has Finnish and Swedish as equal languages and so on. So other countries have managed under a lot of pressure, but the problem is internal.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions that the answers to which you have sort of referred, but I'll give you the two questions. Could you share your insight into Putin's character and motives? And the related one is, could you give us your views on what Putin wants? Where is it all leading? Where does he want it to lead?
Putin wants to stay in power and wants respect. And he feels he has been dealt with disrespect. Frankly, if you are trying to rule a country as varied, with as many deep problems as Russia has, you're not going to be able to do it on the principles of Jeffersonian democracy. It just doesn't work there. And one thing we have to recognize is when we start playing the nanny, you mustn't do this, you mustn't do that, it just not only annoys them, it infuriates them. Now, he feels that he did everything right regarding us when he first became president. He was the first to call President Bush and offer help after 9/11. They facilitated our invasion of Afghanistan and have continued to do so. Letting us use their airspace and so on, giving us intelligence. He removed a tracking station from Cuba. He removed a base from Kamran Bay. He pulled out of these areas. He didn't make that big a deal over the first NATO expansion. Then what do? We walk out of the ABM treaty. We for a long time would not prolong our arms reduction treaties that had verification. That's finally been put back in place only by the Obama administration. And we not only expanded NATO to these, we started putting bases there. And then we got into the whole missile, anti-missile category. So he looks at it that we were calculating, we took advantage of everything he did, and we have pushed. And that what we are doing is acting as a world hegemon and trying to surround Russia and make them simply a producer of raw materials and energy to fuel what is an American empire. Now, you know, that's a total distortion, but so many of our actions, in fact, feed in to this sort of, one could call it paranoia, but in order to keep in power, he has very much limited the ability to demonstrate. When he saw the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, he's convinced this was engineered by the CIA. It wasn't. It was a genuine one, but Westerners and our democratic evangelists were out there, you know, supporting the demonstrators. And what are they to think now when you've got a very anti-Russian government after the revolution in Kiev? Who begins to visit? The head of the CIA goes out there. The vice president goes there. An assistant secretary of state hands out cookies to the demonstrators and talks on the phone to our ambassador about who should be in their government. Would we put up with that in any of our neighboring countries for 1 minute? But that's what's sending Putin up the wall. Now, people say, oh, this guy, he wants to reestablish the Soviet Union. Well, I say, if that's true, let him try. I mean, he can't, and he knows it. But some of these, for the reasons I've already pointed out, are absolutely crucial to Russia's sense of security. And they feel they've been excluded from the alliance, and the alliance is bringing closer and closer, and they had to accept it with the Baltics. But if it comes to something as important as Ukraine or as historically connected as Georgia, no, no way. What he's doing now in tapping Russian nationalism is very, very dangerous for the Soviet Union. That country has over 20% of its population are Muslims and are non-Russians. And there are other non-Russians that are not Muslims. Many of them live near the border. If he pushes this Russian nationalism too much, not only is he going to have a heightened problem of terrorism, but, you know, so the Buryats start saying, well, you know, the Mongolians speak the same language we do. They're living better, if that should be the case. We really would rather be in Mongolia. Then what's he going to do? I mean, that would take Mongolia up to Lake Baikal. So, and, you know, all these Chinese living near the border in the Far East, what's going to happen, you know, in another decade there? So I think he is a calculating way, but mainly, as I said, he wants respect. And particularly from the United States, we have to understand that for Russians, the relationship with the United States is just absolutely crucial. For most Americans, you don't think that much about Russia anymore, maybe during the Soviet Union. And it just doesn't mean that much. But for them, if there is going to be any real development of civil society and eventual democracy, they're going to have to do it with at least the implicit support of the United States, which means, you know, not exaggerating all of these problems with them. There's just no question there has been more development of what you might say a civil society and a middle class in Russia than there has been in Ukraine. Ukraine is much more hampered by its Soviet heritage. It just has not reformed as much. So let's not get mesmerized by Putin, who is in many ways, has clamped down on many privileges, but not all of them by any means. There's still freedom to move, for example. And one of their big problems, in addition to the general demographic one, is that educated younger people are leaving. And a recent poll within the last couple of years indicated that nearly 40% of college-educated Russians between the ages of, say, 21 and 35 would leave the country if they could get a job. Now, this is the brain drain is a real problem. Now, things like taking over Crimea gives him a very temporary boost in popularity. But eventually, these problems are going to come back, and he's going to have to. And the last thing he needs is taking on eastern Ukraine. I think he knows that. Now, that doesn't mean if they get into a civil war, he's going to be able to sit there and not send in some troops to stop it. But to look at it as just simply a land grab, I think, is missing the point.
Okay, this one, and it's interesting because I was going to interject my own question, but here's one that's very similar to what I had in mind. At many of these luncheons, we learn of naive and ill-advised mistakes of U.S. foreign policy. Why is the Foreign Service so screwed up, he says. And the question that I was going to ask is, why didn't Kerry fire Victoria Nuland when she behaved that way? Or was he encouraging her to do that? In which case, why is our foreign policy so screwed up?
Well, you know, I wrote a blog. Well, first of all, on that question, it's not the Foreign Service. The Foreign Service does not make policy. The President and the Secretary of State make policy. And Congress, unfortunately, makes policy. And a Foreign Service officer, like a military officer, you serve your President. And if you think they're doing something terribly illegal or immoral, the only thing you can do is resign. I was never faced with any temptation to do that. But don't blame the Foreign Service, that's first of all. Second, Victoria Nuland, I wrote in my blog, she should be fired immediately and publicly. And that Kerry should order U.S. officials to have no further discussion with the Ukrainians about who should be in their government. You know, this is not international relations 101. This is human psychology, very basic. When, you know, I was faced as ambassador, I don't want to get too long on this, but it's an important point. I was faced as ambassador with the elections beginning to be free in the three Baltic republics, and we had never recognized them as formally part of the Soviet Union. And as a matter of fact, I was formally not supposed, as ambassador of the Soviet Union, to deal with them officially. But once they had elections, they started sending delegations to talk to me about them. And so I received them and listened. And first the Lithuanians, then the Estonians, then the Latvians, they all came separately. And they would talk about their steps first to get autonomy and then independence. And when they got to independence, they say now, and when we declare our independence or the restoration of our independence, of course you will recognize us. And I said, no, we won't. We won't until you are truly independent. Because we can't, and I would say this was true at that time, we can't recognize a government as independent unless you control the territory you claim. And you won't under those circumstances. And then I added, you must be very careful to keep everything peaceful. As you move, you're going to get a lot of provocations. But if there is any violence and the Soviets repress you, haul you all off to jail, there's not a thing we can do. We cannot create a nuclear war for your independence. And I remember when I first told the Lithuanians, who were the first to come in, there was a pause and they said, so we're on our own. And I said, we support you emotionally, but don't think we can save you if you're cracked down. Now, what were we telling the West Ukrainians? Well, keep at it, work with it, and you'll eventually get in NATO. We'll protect you. And then we see what I consider absolutely outrageous articles. The Economist this past week had a thing, you know, who will America defend, or something like that. Well, you know, are we supposed to defend people who've never are not our allies, we've never committed ourselves to? Should that, you know, in say, well, we're not credible for our allies? That's ridiculous. So I think this whole idea that we are not showing, you know, sufficient, we're not standing up to Putin enough, gets it really backwards, because it is this attempt to turn Ukraine against them, which is the way they read it, and using not only our diplomatic forces, but covert means, then that is sending them up the wall. And it isn't going to work. It's not going to deter them. So why do you do it? And this is really the question many of our friends in Moscow were asking. Do you people really understand the impact here and what you're doing?
Okay, this gets back to what we're doing about it. Do you see sanctions against individuals or sanctions in general against Russia as an effective means to prevent what we think they want to do in the Ukraine, and if so, why?
I think sanctions in general are a very poor way to bring about political ends, because usually the political ends for the other side are more important to them than the economics. Now, if it's a matter, do you send in troops or do you sanction? Of course, if you have to make that choice. But, you know, it's not necessarily a good choice. And I do think that we could probably have prevented the takeover of Crimea, if that's what we wanted to do, if the president had quietly simply told him that we will do our best to have the Ukrainians agree to neutrality, and that we will stop any direct interference, unilateral interference, on the formation of the government. In other words, work with the EU and the Russians to put together a government that they can accept. Because you're not going to have a Ukraine in the future that is successful if it doesn't have a reasonable relationship with Russia. That's just common sense. So, but the president said sanctions. That's certainly better than mobilizing troops. You have to do something. And if you have to do it, then do it against individuals rather than whole sectors.
Okay, unfortunately, we've got a whole bunch of questions, but we're running out of time. In fact, we're 5 minutes over, but this is an entirely different direction this question goes in. Under the circumstances, is there any way the United States can work with Putin to find a solution to this Syrian civil war?
You know, I think no, because I think the Syrian civil war is another one. That problem is in Syria. I think that it's really tragic, and I think we have to realize that Assad and his people are fighting for their lives. If they lose, they don't survive physically. Now, they're doing horrible things, but it's not the Russians. You know, the Russians have given them arms, yes, and so on, I don't think the Russians can necessarily dictate an end, particularly if the Syrians, are beginning to regain, the government is beginning to regain control of large areas of the country. What they fear is actually the same thing we should fear, and that is that Al-Qaeda or similar organizations get a place in Syria that they can operate. And what they were telling us early on, you say Assad must go, look what happened in Libya. I mean, Can you guarantee that what follows is not going to be more problem for us? After all, Assad did keep down any attack on Israel. They at times they operated to stabilize things in Lebanon. Do we really want chaos there or expand? You know, this is just a very tricky area. So I don't think so. Now, I do think that we are continue to need Russian support in dealing with Iran, and we have been getting it. It's in their interest to do so. And, you know, if we got a better deal with Iran and so on, we could change a lot in that area. But here again, the problems there are not so much Russian or American problems, but local ones. And the attempt, they would see our effort following on the invasion of Iraq, following on Libya, we are acting, trying to gain control of these countries, failing, but ending up with a situation more threatening to all of us because of the expansion of the jihadists. They really fear that, and that is an area that we should be cooperating. But again, it's the appearance of the U.S. trying to be the arbiter and pushing, and in the final analysis, very quick to use military force. I think that they resisted, not so much in support of Assad, but not wanting, if there is a solution, it to be an American solution, and also doubting that Americans could solve it.
That's unfortunately a depressing note to end on, but this has been a really enlightening talk, and we are delighted that you came up here, and we're also delighted, which I forgot to mention, that you brought your wife with you. So we've got, instead of one of the famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Policy mugs, we've got two to give you. It was terrific. As I said, I just wish we could have gone on a long time.